This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening, Africa. Welcome to VOA Africa, and thank you for joining us. I'm Jason Patinkin, and here's what's coming up.
We're making the point that more people died of malaria in Africa last year by a factor of maybe four than died of COVID. So why isn't malaria a priority?
That was Adrian Hill, director of Oxford University's Jenner Institute, on a potential new malaria vaccine that could help prevent over 400,000 deaths a year. This story and more coming up on Africa News Tonight. Our top story today is in Chad, where there was the funeral today for late President Idriss Deby Itno, who died of combat wounds while visiting troops fighting rebel forces in the country's north. Several African political leaders, plus French President Emmanuel Macron and other dignitaries, were among those gathered in N'Djamena. Meanwhile, rebels of the Front for Change and Concord in Chad, or FACT, said warplanes bombed one of their command centers Wednesday night. They accused France, which backs Chad's newly established military council led by Deby's son, of supporting the alleged raid with aerial surveillance. The French army said today it had not carried out any airstrikes this week in Chad, but did not respond to Reuters' requests for comment. Reporter Moki Edwin Kinzeka traveled to N'Djamena for Deby's funeral today. I spoke with him about what he saw. Moki, thank you so much for joining us. First of all, can you describe what was the funeral like today?
Now, hundreds of people turned out at the ceremonial ground, the funeral ground today in N'Djamena. Most of them were mourning, and a lot of them are family members of the late president of Chad, Idriss Deby Itno, and his supporters. There were about six African leaders and the president of France, Emmanuel Macron. All of them who came out had very positive memories of late President Idriss Deby Itno. They presented him as somebody who was a pan-Africanist, somebody who fought against insecurity, especially terrorism in Mali, in northern Cameroon with the Boko Haram insurgency, in Nigeria, in Chad, and in Niger. So they had very good memories of him. They described him as somebody who worked for the development of Africa and who wanted economic progress in all of the continent.
And what's the security situation like in N'Djamena? Are there soldiers in the streets? Are people moving about normally?
Security in N'Djamena is watertight. In fact, you cannot move 5 meters without finding security men heavily armed. And this has scared residents who have gone back into their houses. They say they are afraid of the unknown. It is understandably so because of the threats that the rebels have been giving. Yesterday in the evening, some rebel factions warned the heads of state who are coming for the funeral not to step foot on N'Djamena. According to them, coming for the funeral is synonymous to supporting a dictatorship. They say they don't understand why somebody who have led the country for 30 years like Idriss Deby should be killed and his son, Mahamat Idriss Deby, takes over power.
As you said, people are staying inside, but if you've had a chance to talk to some regular citizens in N'Djamena, what are they saying about the new military council led by Deby's son, Mahamat Kaka?
I spoke to people, a few of them are in support of the military council. They think that it may be dangerous for Chad now should any other person who is not close to the military be called over to lead. But a majority seem to be against the military council. They are saying that the military council is made up of those who share the same ideas like President Idriss Deby. They are accusing the military council of being responsible for the underdevelopment of Chad. In fact, a young man of about 27, he gave his name as Zanali, told me this morning that he had been a teacher trained and has been in the job market for over 7 years. He says thousands of them are like that in Chad, and they're blaming the leadership, the long rule of President Idriss Deby. They also say he appointed members of his family to almost all the positions, like his son, who is Mahamat, who is taking over now. So they see the governing council as something that should not have happened in Chad. They say they should hand over to civilian rule as early as possible.
How do the regular Chadian citizens that you've spoken to view France's support for the military council?
of people we discuss with are against the French president, their anti-French sentiments. They are saying that it is not good for President Macron to support what they call a dictatorship. They think that democracy, what they call real democracy, should be tried in the Republic of Chad. And they see the support the French president, Emmanuel Macron, has given the Transitional Military Council as some sort of acceptance of dictatorship in Chad, and France wanting to protect only its interests, not the interests of the Chadian people.
That's reporter Moki Edwin-Kinzaka speaking to me from Djamena. Debbie's death has raised concerns about stability in not only Chad, but throughout West and Central Africa. While critics point out Debbie's authoritarian 31-year rule, security experts say he was also an essential ally to Western nations in the fight against terrorism and are worried about what comes next. Annika Hammerschlag reports from Dakar, Senegal.
Debbie presided over one of the largest and most well-resourced militaries in West Africa. His forces provided crucial support to international security efforts in the Lake Chad Basin and the Sahel, where Islamist militant groups have wreaked havoc in recent years. That's likely why Western powers, such as France and the U.S., turned a blind eye to the ever-mounting accusations of human rights abuses and to his habit of suppressing political opposition. John Campbell is a former U.S. ambassador to Nigeria and a senior fellow for Africa Policy Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations, a Washington-based think tank.
In terms of the struggle against jihadism, his death is a distinct setback. The Chadian army was probably the most efficient fighting force in West Africa, again, with the exception of the French. And the question will be whether the regime continues the effort or not.
Debbie was killed by a Libyan-based rebel group while visiting troops on the front lines Monday. The event took place shortly after he was declared the winner of the April 11th elections, which were boycotted by opposition groups over accusations of political sidelining. The win would have marked the start of Debbie's sixth term. A transitional military council appointed Debbie's son, General Mahama Idriss Debbie, as interim leader until democratic elections can be held in 18 months. Paul Simon Handy is a senior regional advisor with the Institute of Security Studies in Dakar.
There is uncertainty about the immediate future of Chad. There is uncertainty about the stability of the current interim arrangement by the military council. There is uncertainty about unity within the ranks of the army. Islamist insurgents can actually use this opportunity to further destabilize Chad.
This could have ripple effects across West Africa. If Debbie's son does not earn the loyalty of Chad's armed forces, the region could lose a key player in the fight against Islamic extremists. Daniel Izenga is a research fellow with the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, a U.S. Defense Department research institution.
There's the possibility that command and control over the armed forces may falter. The fact that the military council has tried to take up control suggests that there's just a great deal of instability that may in fact lead to having a harder time contributing troops to those kinds of regional efforts in the Sahel or Lake Chad Basin.
Violent events linked to jihadist groups in the Sahel have increased sevenfold since 2017, according to the center, while the Lake Chad Basin saw a 60% increase in 2020 over the year prior. Annika Hammerschlag for VOA News, Dakar.
Also staying with Chad, UN investigators say the secret of the Chadian rebels' success recently lies in their involvement in the war across the border in Libya. The rebels have been fighting for years for the commander of the rebel Libyan National Army, led by General Khalifa Haftar. They've amassed money, battlefield experience, and weapons, some of which were supplied to Haftar by the United Arab Emirates. Wolfgang Putzai, a former Austrian military attaché, discusses this backdrop with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi.
Yes, exactly. What you explained is exactly ongoing since years. And this is also the main reason why the French strategic interests in Libya are focused on the south, and why they have cooperated also with Haftar's Libyan National Army, and why they are now somehow stunned about the recent developments. There are several different criminal and rebel groups from Chad operating from and in Libya. All of them attempted incursions in Chad over the years. Some were stopped by the French Air Force. Furthermore, more or less all fighters from the Toubou tribe, who settle on both sides of the border, are frequently considered in Libya as Chadian mercenaries, regardless if they're actually Libyans or Chadis. From the real Chadian rebels, there are two main groups in Libya, the FECT and the CCMSR, Many of them are Tobu fighters, and both have declared their neutrality as an organization in the battle for Tripoli. Nevertheless, several individuals from both groups were fighting for the pro-GNA groups like the former Gaddafi general Ali Khanna at Tuareg, while many others were fighting in the ranks of the Libyan National Army. But most significantly is that the fact the rebel group which invaded Chad recently did not only stay in more or less LNA-controlled areas after they took them away from Misrata in 2017, but they guarded on behalf of the LNA also some oil installations in southern Libya. Nevertheless, Haftar, who was always on very good terms with Idris Deby, had an ambivalent relationship with the fact. The LNA was simply too weak to kick them out, and it seems to be there was something like a non-aggression pact between them, although Haftar's air force even bombed them at times to discipline them. Nevertheless, this was the beginning of the end for Idris Deby.
In a statement on Wednesday, the rebels who go by the name Front of Change and Concord in Chad, FACT, threatened to march on N'Djamena this weekend following President Idris Deby's funeral, which is planned for Friday. Given the fact that the Chadian army has been stretched north, east, and south, would the rebels be able to take over the capital?
If the Chadian army is able to maintain its unity, this is unlikely. Idris Deby's son Mohammed, who established now this military council, heads the elite presidential guard, and he enjoys the loyalty of the other elite forces of Chad's considerable armed forces. But he will need to concentrate the most reliable and best-trained army forces in the north, which will expose the south, as you've indicated, to other insurgencies and eventually also allow conflicts in neighboring countries like in Sudan's Darfur to flame up again. I expect that in extremis, it is also likely that the French Air Force, which has a base in N'Djamena, will intervene to stop any major rebel advance on N'Djamena. One must keep in mind that the French Operation Barkhane for the whole Sahel region is headquartered in N'Djamena.
That was Wolfgang Putsai, former Austrian military attaché, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi. The International Organization for Migration says up to 130 people have died in a shipwreck off the coast of Libya. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Apparently, calls for rescue from the people on board the rubber dinghy went unheeded. International Organization for Migration spokeswoman Safa Micheli says the boat, reportedly carrying 130 people, was in distress for 2 days before it sank in the central Mediterranean.
For 2 days, the NGO Alarm Phone, which is responsible for sending distress calls to the relevant maritime rescue centers in the Mediterranean region, has been calling on states to uphold their responsibilities towards these people and send rescue vessels. Unfortunately, that has not happened.
Micheli says the independent rescue group SOS Mediterranee sent a vessel, the Ocean Viking, in search of the boat. Unfortunately, when it arrived on the scene Thursday evening, she says the crew was confronted with the distressing sight of dozens of bodies flowing around the capsized dinghy. She says this tragedy comes 2 days after another boat carrying around 103 migrants was intercepted by the Libyan Coast Guard. She says a mother and her child were found dead on that boat. The survivors have been returned to Libya and are being detained in a government facility.
There are further reports of a third boat carrying up to 40 people. We have no news on this boat. It's been out there at sea for 3 days. And again, we fear that the worst has happened given the status and the state of these boats, given the length and the duration that people are spending in what remains the most dangerous sea crossing in the world.
International law obliges states to rescue people at sea. However, as attitudes harden in Europe against asylum seekers and migrants, most of whom come from Africa and the Middle East, more countries are violating the law. Countries like Italy and Malta have barred migrant vessels from disembarking in their ports, and European countries have imposed fines on private vessels, such as the Ocean Viking, and imposed rules making it difficult for them to rescue migrants at sea. The IOM says the latest deaths bring the total number of people who have lost their lives in the central Mediterranean Mediterranean this year to 650. That is more than a fourfold increase in the number of recorded deaths over the same period last year. However, Micheli notes the IOM's ability to monitor deaths in the central Mediterranean has been drastically reduced because of the absence of state search and rescue vessels. So she says the actual number of deaths is likely to be much higher. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
As the conflict in northern Ethiopia's Tigray region enters its sixth month, the UN Security Council has broken its silence to call for scaled-up humanitarian access and a, quote, restoration of normalcy, end quote. The statement yesterday from the 15-nation council also expressed deep concern about reports of sexual and gender-based violence against women and girls in Tigray, calling for investigations and accountability, but not directly condemning them. For analysis of the UN Security Council statement, I reached out to Richard Gowan, who directs the International Crisis Group's UN program in New York. Hello, Richard.
Hi, Jason.
So, first of all, the fighting in Tigray has been going on for more than 5 months. Tens of thousands of people are believed to be dead, hundreds of thousands displaced. There are allegations of mass atrocities, including massacres of hundreds of civilians, mass rape of women and girls. Now there are reports of people starving to death. Why has it taken so long for the Security Council to say anything?
I think there are three main factors. Firstly, the African members of the Security Council were initially wary of making a public statement because they wanted the African Union to take the lead in this crisis. But as the conflict has gone on, the African group has become more willing to consider some sort of UN intervention. Secondly, the Biden administration has been very keen to see the UN make an intervention, and Ambassador Linda Thomas-Greenfield really kicked off the process leading up to this statement by putting pressure on her colleagues in the Security Council and asking why they weren't doing more. And finally, China and Russia have been skeptical about UN action, but I think they felt the need to let some sort of statement go through because they do recognize that there is a lot of public concern about what's going on in Tigray.
And looking at the council statement, it calls for a return to normalcy. What does this mean? Why not outright call for a ceasefire?
Early drafts of the statement did have stronger language on ceasing hostilities. But frankly, council members have quite different analyses of the situation on the ground. And the Russians in particular are not willing to recognize that this conflict is still actually very active. And so there was a lengthy process of negotiation to find some sort of language that everyone could buy into. And I think that Russia and China were also keen to ensure that Ethiopia would swallow this language. And that is also why it is relatively soft.
Now, the Ethiopian government released a statement in response, and that statement said that, quote, the law enforcement operation in Ethiopia is an internal affair regulated by the laws of the country, including human rights laws. The operation undertaken to restore law and order in the Tigray region is within the sovereign purview of the state, end quote. What's your take on this response?
I think the Ethiopians are relatively satisfied with the statement, because it is quite soft. And also, there's one very notable gap in what the Security Council said. And that is the Security Council makes no reference to the presence of Eritrean troops who have been working with Ethiopian forces to fight the TPLF. Now, earlier drafts of the text had made a reference to the Eritreans. Clearly, the US and a lot of other council members feel that the Eritreans should withdraw from Ethiopia. But China and Russia blocked that language. And also, I think some of the African Council members were nervous about it too. So Ethiopia, I think, sees that as a win. And it just wants to keep on repeating its narrative that this is an internal affair.
And so what's next? What do you think needs to be done to bring about a stop to the fighting and an end to the suffering in Tigray?
Well, I think the Security Council statement is at least a basis for improving humanitarian assistance in Tigray and improving humanitarian access in Tigray. But in security and political terms, It's crucial, in our view, that Eritrean forces do start to pull back from Ethiopia. And it's crucial that the government in Addis Ababa looks for a political solution to a conflict which, in our view, is very far from over, is not just a matter of some sporadic insecurity, but is actually still a very serious conflict and could go on for some time.
That was Richard Gowan, who directs the International Crisis Group's UN program in New York. Richard, thanks for joining us.
Always happy to be in touch.
Separately, Ethiopia's chief government ombudsman told AFP today that at least 100 people have been killed in the country's restive Amhara region. His figures could not be independently verified. In an exclusive interview with VOA, Adrian Hill, the director of Oxford University's Jenner Institute, says their new malaria vaccine has shown a preliminary efficacy rate of 77% in testing in Burkina Faso. If further studies prove the vaccine effective, it could help prevent over 400,000 deaths a year, most of them in sub-Saharan Africa. Henry Wilkins reports from Kaya, Burkina Faso.
Pella Sawadogo fled to Gaji village 2 years ago when insurgents attacked, killing her neighbors and brother-in-law. The 32-year-old thought she had escaped sudden death, but last week one of her just months-old twin daughters, Marie, was diagnosed with malaria. She got some more medicine, says Sawadogo, and they were told to go back home. She says that was the last prescription she got before her daughter passed away at home on Sunday. It affected me a lot, says Sawadogo. I can't sleep at night, she says. I can't eat. More than 400,000 people die every year from the mosquito-borne disease, most within sub-Saharan Africa, and mostly children under 5 years old. But there is hope. In an exclusive interview with VOA, the director of Oxford University's Jenner Institute says their new malaria vaccine, tested in Burkina Faso, is showing game-changing results.
So what's so exciting about this result is that 140 malaria vaccine candidates have been tried in clinical trials over the years, and none of them has come up with an efficacy over 75%. That's what the WHO, the World Health Organization, is looking for to be really useful in controlling malaria in Africa. In our first attempt with this vaccine, we see 77%, and we think we can improve on that further. So it's real progress. It's unprecedented.
Adrian Hill says the cost of the new vaccine is expected to be very low and believes widespread use would prevent hundreds of thousands of deaths in Africa each year. While testing is not yet complete, the initial results are also raising hopes with medical aid groups like Doctors Without Borders, MSF. The coordinator of MSF's malaria working group, Dr. Martin de Smet, spoke from Brussels.
If the modalities, the characteristics would make it well feasible to roll out in Africa, that could indeed be a game changer.
The malaria vaccine is entering the final phase of trials in Burkina Faso, Kenya, Mali and Tanzania, and could be widely available in as little as 2 years. But Hill says the Jenner Institute, which developed the AstraZeneca coronavirus vaccine, is talking to regulators to see if this vaccine can also be fast-tracked for quicker use.
We're making the point that more people died of malaria in Africa last year by a factor of maybe four than died of COVID. So why isn't malaria a priority?
The malaria vaccine will come too late to save the millions who have died over the years, including Sawadogo's daughter Marie. But perhaps, by the time her twin Pauline is old enough to understand what happened to her sister, malaria deaths could be a rarity in Africa, instead of a day-to-day reality. Henry Wilkins for VOA News, Kaya, Burkina Faso.
In Somalia, opposition leaders have welcomed the African Union's move to condemn a term extension that lawmakers gave themselves and the president. Somalia's information minister was less receptive to the measure and accused Kenya and Djibouti of interfering with Somalia's internal affairs. The AU Peace and Security Council expressed deep concern over the votes by Somalia's lower house of parliament this month to extend the mandate of President Mohamed Abdoulaye Farmaajo by 2 years. The AU said the move undermines the unity and stability of Somalia. Lawmakers extended Farmaajo's mandate after political leaders could not agree on the electoral process, despite heavy pressure from the AU, the United States, and the European Union. On Friday, the federal government of Somalia, however, did welcome a renewed AU initiative to facilitate talks on holding elections. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Jason Patinkin. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mabile Yabaro, and our editor, Paul Alexander, thank you for tuning in and choosing The Voice of America. Stay safe, stay healthy, and have a great evening.